Welcome to the Agile Book Club. Here are your hosts, Justina and Paul.
Oh my goodness. Listeners, we have had a rough time making this podcast.
Yes.
I was going to say, one of my first banter items on my banter list, because I have a banter list, obviously. Don't we all? Don't we all? Was that this is the first episode of season 4 of the Agile Book Club podcast. We are celebrating 3 years of never missing a deadline until this episode.
Yes, and I take the full responsibility for that, dear listeners, which is a great example of sometimes you can try your best, but you might be in the circumstances that won't let you do it. I was actually traveling and I was in Egypt and I thought, okay, I will be at the good hotel for the recording of the podcast. I will buy additional internet. I will change the room to not be facing the street too much because it's extremely loud. I will locate myself into the wardrobe and for sure everything will go great. No, it did not happen. Procrastination doesn't help. I should have committed to record the podcast before the holidays. So great lesson of 2023. Everything is option until it becomes commitment. Yeah, I think that we learned on that. I waited too long. I postponed the episode too long. And I'm sorry. It's all on me.
Well, you know that actually is a natural segue to what is probably going to be our next special episode for the Patreon subscribers. And I just finished reading a book called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals, I think is the
yes. The
subtitle. And it is, I'm not going to give away too much because it's a whole episode, but it's not about time management. It's about how impossible time management is. And you know, we're human. We have to forgive ourselves.
Yeah. But you know, Paul, it brings me back to the story from one of the first ACEs when I was like so proud of myself when our dear friend Eva Koprowska asked like, how is the preparation for ACE? She asked it during the conference. And I said, great. I made my Excel spreadsheet with all of the things that can go wrong and with all of the possible actions that I can take. And she said, it's not going to work. And I remember at that moment, I felt like slightly offended because I thought I'm so smart, you know, I did my best and stuff. But then I realized, she was wrong. Yeah,
indeed. But we're here. Yeah. We're here. It's 2023.
Yes.
Who would have thought that that baby in 1970 would make it to this?
Oh, yes. Me neither. I wouldn't think of it.
And you weren't born yet.
Yes. So should we go to the elevator pitches that will take us to the book of this month?
Indeed, I think we should. I've actually got too many things to talk about aside from this book. And so I think we should just keep it all for the after show and get right into this book, because you gave me a heads up during our brief moment when we were actually able to speak to each other to give me the indication that we might have a different point of view on this book. And I'm very
yes.
curious to hear what you have to say. So why don't you lead off with, oh, by the way, we should mention the book, obviously. So what we read for this month is Leadership by Design by, we picked a Pole this time. You know, Justyna is Polish. She doesn't live in Poland. I'm not Polish. I do live in Poland. And so Poland is tangentially related to the podcast. And I think this is our first Polish author. Her name is Aga Szustek.
Yes, it's the first.
So what did you think? What's your pitch?
Okay, so I have to say, it was the most beautiful book I ever hold in my hands. I would never pay attention to those details if you wouldn't teach me how to do it. But I loved how it looked like. I loved the paper. I loved design. I loved font. It was like really a nice surprise when I got the book. When it comes to the content of the book and for whom I would recommend it, I struggled here a bit because I had very positive and negative feeling about book at the same time. So I think this book would be good read for more experienced leaders, because if I would be the leader that doesn't have too much experience, I wouldn't learn too much from the book. Why? Because it brings a lot of different ideas in a very brief way. It doesn't go into detail of an idea. It just touch upon vulnerability from Brené Brown, about rethinking from Adam Grant, about a lot of different ideas, but it doesn't go deep in any of them. So me as a leader, not experienced one, I would just treat it as a nice looking book that I can read through the holidays. The other aspect of the book, I think it is wonderful because it has 12 chapters. It has 12 week program that can help you to become the better leader. But if you don't do any of the homework, it's just pointless. You know, I read this book twice. The first time I read was without looking at the homeworks, and I was not happy with the book. The second time when I read and I look at the homework, I was like, okay, that makes all sense. That really it's a nice 12-week program of self-improvement for the leader. But it has so much exercises that I don't know if I know anyone so committed with so much time that can get through it. So it is why I have a little bit mixed feeling about the book, from wow, so beautiful, I want to keep it on my shelf. It was nice compilation of everything most of the things I knew, through I don't know how useful that would be for any leader. And now I'm so happy to hear your opinion and your elevator pitch.
Well, you want to know what's funny is I was thinking about the target audience for this book, who I would recommend it to. And one of the people in mind was you. For exactly this reason. And you touched on it yourself, is that very much like the wonderful book, Agile Conversations, I would not recommend that book to any lazy person. Mm. You can read it and learn nothing at all. The value comes from the doing.
Yes.
And by the same token, this book it says it's a 12-week program. I don't buy it. I think it's probably more like a 24-week program or a 12. I don't know. What has 12 things in it?
Months.
All right. A year.
Yes, yes. Welcome in the new year, Paul.
This might actually be a one-year program. So listeners, 2023 might be the year that you discover how to become the leader you were meant to be. Mm. But you want to know what I like about it? I've read a lot of books about leadership. They're often either formulaic or, I can't remember the word, is it hagiography? Something like this. Like a biography that makes a person sound like just a god.
Yeah. Like the thought leaders. Yeah, all of those thought leaders.
So it's either like a formulaic leadership or how to lead like Jack Welch. Well, you know who can lead like that? Jack Welch?
Jack Welch.
Because I was looking at this and I was thinking, you know, this is the leadership book for anyone.
Yeah.
Because when you think of the great leaders of our time, you know, Steve Jobs, Oprah Winfrey, what do they have in common? Nothing. They both became rich, but otherwise nothing. Jack Welch, Arianna Huffington, you know, these people are completely different. There is no one way to lead. And what I liked about this book is it's a workbook. It's an exploration into how to find the leader in yourself. And the leader in yourself is the person who actually believes in something.
Hmm.
And knows what that thing is and knows why and can communicate it in a way that motivates the people around them. Or, as the author says, if it doesn't, you know you can leave, which is going to be one of my takeaways. I'm not going to get ahead of myself. But I actually thought that this was a great book for absolutely anybody who is willing to do the work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this applies to even existing leaders, because I coach people who are very senior who have not done this level of introspection and would benefit from it. But by the same token, kind of like our friend April Mills says, you know, a leader is anybody who inspires another person to behave differently. Not her exact words, but her general idea. And so if even a junior member of a team, you know, a designer or a tester reads this book, they will discover something about themselves that will make them more influential in the world. And so for that reason, I thought it was brilliant because it's like basic introspection 101 mm-hmm. for people who have never done it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I like that. But you know, the other thing I like is that this author is outside our bubble. You know, so often the authors we read know each other and read each other and cite each other. And her background is psychology. And so even though I recognize a lot of her citations, they're from outside her industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's refreshing, kind of, to not see the same ideas just regurgitated.
Mm-hmm. And you know what also I liked about the book? That she had some references to Alice from Wonderland, yeah? To the Big Bang Theory, like the pop culture, like for the things that maybe not every single person, but a lot of people actually know. So I really appreciate that as well. Yeah, that was refreshing. That's true. Yeah.
So although there was one chapter that I think made me feel the way that you were expressing mm-hmm. with the book, and that was the chapter on decision making, which was so unbelievably lightweight. I mean, after we've explored concepts like cost or delay, anti-fragility, real options, there's so many decision-making frameworks and tools and such. That was a missed opportunity. Mm. The decision-making chapter was really super lightweight. But otherwise, I mean, the questions and the exercises in it were good.
Mm.
So overall, I think it sounds like we kind of agree with each other.
Yes.
And yet we've approached it from different points of view.
Yes.
Like, You're the pessimist. You're like, nobody's going to do this 12-week program. So, and I'm like, everyone should do this 12-week program.
But Paul, isn't that funny? Because I think like a few years ago, it would be completely reverse. I would take the assumption that every single person would do it. And you would be the...
But you've been doing product management for a few years now, so you know.
Yes. I'm broken. But I think, Paul, yes, we agree. Because when we approached the recording of this podcast the first time and I said that I didn't like the book and you told me that you liked the book, I reread the book again because I had to understand. And then I was like, okay, now it makes sense. If you are willing to do the homework, that is a good book. If you are not willing, spend your money maybe on the other way. Okay. Takeaways.
I have 27.
What?
I have 27 takeaways from this book. There's no way we're going to get into all of them during this podcast.
Oh my God. You can start. I went first with the elevator pitch. You can go with the first takeaway.
It's this. And I think this is like the big takeaway, like the big high-end takeaway, which is that there are a number of different leadership models that you can choose from. But if you use any of them, you are following some other leadership model. You are acting like a leader. Acting like a leader. You're stepping on the stage. You get out of bed, a person. You brush your teeth, a person. You eat breakfast, a person. You drive to the office, a person. You walk into the office and you pretend to be a leader for 8 hours. And then you drive home to your family. And it's just this, which is that leadership comes from having a unique vision that you're passionate about and that you can express in a way that makes other people feel excited about the same vision. And if you haven't done the work, then you're just acting like a leader. And it makes me wonder how many people out there, I'm guessing most, how many people out there at the top of organizations are spending their days acting like a leader and driving home feeling like a fraud.
Hmm. And you know, if I could jump into, because it really nicely binds with my takeaway, when she was saying that you have to trust yourself, that we trust the leaders who trust themselves. And if you feel as a leader for 24 hours, it is so much easier to trust yourself. You don't have to do this emotional labor to convince yourself. Yeah, you don't have to do so much labor to convince others, because by seeing you, everyone thinks that you are the leader, but seeing your actions, but feeling the way you make those people feel. And one of the things that she also mentioned is that if we have mistrust towards each other as leaders, if we have mistrust towards ourselves, it really it is really visible for the rest of people. We have more hesitation. We are more willing to play some games, to try to put the makeup on the peak that is our confidence. And all of those things, which just creates like a huge unnecessary story. When for everyone in our surrounding, they want to see us as a person, as a human being, that they can say, okay, I trust you. I want to work with you. And I think one more thing that I didn't read in any other book. She said, like, so often we express our trust to people, but we never say that we don't trust them to their face, or very rarely that we have this kind of the relationship that we can look into the person and say, I'm sorry, I don't trust you on that, you know? And we don't have the conversations about lack of trust, or we don't have enough conversation about lack of trust. I remember when once I tried to have that conversation in the previous company, it didn't end up good. I wanted to rebuild my trust. So I said, honestly, I don't trust you. What could we do? Those are the reasons why I don't trust you. And the feedback that I got is like, I lost the fire. I lost my commitment. The conversation was totally shifted. So I think as leaders, we have to trust ourselves, and we have to encourage the conversations when we see that someone is missing the trust towards us.
Interesting, because one of my other takeaways was about this idea of trust. Mm. In fact, two of my takeaways were about this idea of trust, which she deals with. One of them, she describes as either pragmatic trust and emotional trust. And pragmatic trust is the decision to trust, the decision to act as though you trust someone, which can also be expressed as assuming positive intent.
Yes.
Right? And she says that enough of that, especially when it's reciprocated properly and you trust somebody and they perform, and you trust someone and they perform, it eventually turns into emotional trust as that positive intent is manifested. And it sounds like, I mean, not to psychoanalyze your ex coworkers, bosses, whatever, that they just thought that pragmatic trust was something you owed them regardless of their behavior.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that's a good one. Yeah.
And that doesn't sound healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pragmatic trust that is never reciprocated, not reciprocated, pragmatic trust that is never manifested as clear expression of positive intent is just naivety.
Yes. That's a nice one. And what did you combine your two takeaways in one right now, or you have one more regarding trust?
No. The other one about trust. The other one about trust was that leaders who are not trusting also evidence other behaviors, and she sums this up as assuming ill intentions and anticipating failure. And the definition of failure in this case is any deviation from their expectations.
Could you explain
that? Which is interesting, because if you have a lack of trust from a leader and they assume ill intentions, they're likely to become more controlling. And we've talked about outcomes versus outputs and such on this podcast before. And so it may very well be that by describing the outputs that they want, a team can deliver the right outcomes, but with the wrong outputs, and be perceived as failure because they didn't follow instructions.
Okay, I get it.
Which I think is she didn't say that in so many words, but that's what I took away from it, which is that if you are a mistrusting leader, you're going to have a tendency to micromanage, you're going to have a tendency to describe the exact outputs you want, and the team then, even if they understand the outcome, even if they know where they're going, are going to be more careful, less inventive, and are going to try to give you the outputs that you've asked for rather than the outcome that you collectively agree is the right outcome.
Okay. Yes. I see your point. It makes me feel a little bit about Polish school system, that you really had to follow the prescribed steps, for example, in the math task to get this particular result. If you would do it different way, no. 0 points, 0 points. It's wrong. Yeah. Okay. I see your point. Okay. So I take the next one. It was at the beginning of the book, and I think that it could be also included into introduction of the book, the topic about emotional labor, how much it takes from us to become better, to become better leaders, that it's not given by default. Like, we are not born the best of possible, you know, leaders. Maybe there is a percentage of people that have all of the required skills that are needed just by default, but I don't believe it. And she says, like, it takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of brutal honesty to practice becoming leader, to have this muscle, that we have to treat it, that we are just training a muscle, that it's not given that, oh, he's a good leader because he was born a good leader. No, maybe she read this book, did this 12 weeks program twice because they were not satisfied with the outcome. And that's the reason why they are having the results as they're having, why other people trust them, why they know what kind of leader they aspire and they try to be. And I always have a little bit of hesitation if someone tells me, oh, you did it great, it was easy for you. I have a little like, why don't you see how much it costed me, you know, how much time it takes. And in this book, when she says about emotional labor, I think it resonated with me a lot. And I think a lot of people should try to practice their leadership and should be aware that it's not going to be easy, but it's not that they are just not leaders. It just means that they need practice, and that's all.
I love the way you paraphrase Candide there. The best of all possible leaders.
Yes.
Just trust, just have faith.
Yeah.
If I can go back towards the beginning of the book, which is about developing your own understanding of who you are as a leader, which is not so different than understanding who you are as a person, in all fairness. I like the bit about really looking at the stories that you tell yourself and about your world, where you come from, where you're going, and why, and extrapolating or taking from that, what are your beliefs? Now, there's an interesting thing she pointed out, which is this idea about irrational and rational beliefs. So irrational beliefs are I won't put words into her mouth, but some of your beliefs are irrational. And I don't particularly like that term, because rational and irrational describe different systems of logic, and they have there's a kind of judgment that goes along with it. Like, rationality takes you to truth, irrationality takes you away from truth, and I'm not sure that's literally properly true. I prefer to think of it as helpful and unhelpful idea systems, unhelpful and helpful belief systems. But what I liked about this, and I liked this so much, I shared it with my son, and he wrote them down, and he finds these useful. And that is looking for those irrational or unhelpful beliefs can be facilitated by looking for those instances in which you find that you have ideas in your head that, when they confront reality, cause you to feel anger, because your ideas about the way the world ought to be are confronted with the way the world is, and there's a disconnect there, or because they pull you into kind of a vicious cycle in which you're doing more of the same thing to get out of the situation, and you just keep getting deeper and deeper and deeper, and as well unhelpful behaviors that you do anyway, like, I keep doing this thing and it never works. And so those are like three little tick boxes, three little things to look at, to be aware of, that might be indications, not that you're wrong or bad, but that you're telling yourself a story about the world and your place in it, which is not a good model. It's not helpful for you.
Mm. Yeah,
I appreciate the practicality of that.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. And that was actually one of the exercises that I did. And yes, it's very helpful. And I also confronted it with Tom. I also confronted it with another person. And he was extremely inspiring for more irrational beliefs that I had, which for me were very rational. But after the discussion, I discovered, actually, no. So yes, that's a good exercise. Okay. So another one from me. The art of possibility. And I have here a little bit caveat because I have it as a positive and negative takeaway. So on the positive side, so what she says, it's if you stop looking at yourself through the category, am I good enough? Am I good enough leader? You will release some brain power because you will be less terrified of the failure. You will know that this failure does not define you, that it doesn't mean that you are not good for the job, that you should never, ever talk with anyone else. It will help you to act better on the daily basis. And she says that there are the three practices that can help you to have this attitude. The first one is to see yourself as a contributor rather than leader. And I think that follows with so many books that we've read, especially in the product management, when they say, okay, as a product manager, you don't have to be alpha and omega. You have to facilitate, empower other people and so on. So yes, the first one, it's see yourself as a contributor, not as a leader in every single topic. The second one is to give yourself an A before you start doing something. So it's a practice of a self-acceptance. By this, you already feel like you succeeded. You have this positive feeling. You are less afraid of failure. And I had a moment of hesitation here because as much as I agree with it, I think it makes you feel good. Like, for example, sometimes when I go into the decision, like I go for the job interview and I have the attitude, if I get the job, wonderful. If I don't get the job, it's wonderful too, because I can do this and that. And I'm relaxed at the interview. That was my attitude this summer. So for that thing, I think give yourself A before you start doing something. It's a great thing. But on the other hand, I don't know why I had a little bit clinched, like, I don't agree, you know, fully. Like, I don't think that we can approach every single problem or every single conversation in that way. I don't think that we should every single time give ourselves A because it might make us a little bit less motivated. It might make us feel that we always are going to succeed because we already got A. I don't know. I just could not make my mind around that practice. As I said, I had positive feeling about it. And then I was a little bit anxious, but I don't know why. The third thing that she said is the rule number 6, which means don't take yourself seriously. And I agree with that. And I'm so happy that nowadays we are more encouraged to be who we are, that we are encouraged to be the leaders, the human being as we feel like it, not this people dressed in suit that know everything and will tell you how to live your life, because that was my vision of a leader when I was studying. That was, I was taught, you know, as a dress code and the importance of your tone, of looking confident and saying that you know, even if you don't know. So I think that those three practices can help you on the daily basis to feel that you are enough, which can help you to have more brain power to focus on the things around you rather than on constant validation. But still, I don't know, Paul, if you had any thought about practice number 2, give yourself an A. If yes, please tell me, because maybe that will help me.
Yeah, I've got 2 thoughts. One is that that's probably something we should explore with her when okay. We've got her on the line, because I imagine that it stems from some actual clinical research
okay.
and that it's contextual.
Mm-hmm.
And so So I think the context might be useful, and it might not have been as well communicated as it might have been. And so there might be some edges there, as she might say, that need to be explored. The other thing, one of the things you said about the guys in suits triggered me, because that's one of the things about this book that was amusingly irritating, is that she uses very poetic language. There's lots of metaphor, there's lots of stories, but some of them just go wrong, just so wrong. Like, for example, she says, "A well-tailored suit fits better over time, but if you put on a suit that's made for somebody else, you can feel it was made for somebody else." And as a small man who can't wear clothes off the rack, I can tell you, when you pay $5,000 for a tailored suit, it fits perfectly before you walk out of the tailor's office. If it doesn't, you don't pay for it. Suits fit worse over time because you gain weight or lose weight, or the fabric starts to lose some of its shape over time. But a tailored suit never fits better than on the day you put it on in the tailor's dressing room, wardrobe, whatever. Or for example, as an alternative, like holding up as a contrast to a command and control leader, she offers an 18th century ship captain.
Yes.
That is the definition. His title is literally master and commander. There's nothing more command and control than an 18th century ship captain. So sometimes she tries really hard to be poetic and it just doesn't quite land.
Yes.
But it's always funny the way it doesn't land.
Mm.
Anyway. Okay. So I guess it wouldn't actually be an episode of the Agile Book Club podcast if I didn't have a rant.
Oh, okay.
And so that was it. That was my rant.
So short.
Yeah. It was that good of a book. That's all the rant I can get out of it.
Oh my God, I'm shocked.
Couple of metaphors that didn't land. Woo-hoo.
Okay, so maybe I will just jump with one more takeaway because it goes beautifully. The joy of being wrong. So I hope when she listens to our podcast and she learns about the metaphors that didn't land in the perfect way with us, she will follow the rule that it's presented in the book, which means that we should be more like scientists to be excited about being wrong, because that means that we already learned something. And I was always terrified when I was finding out I'm wrong. I was, you know, I was angry at myself that I didn't think about it, that I did it wrong. All of those horrible, horrible things. But since some time, I started enjoying that because I feel I move forward. And what she also says, it's the cognitive flexibility that enables us to switch between different concepts and behaviors to achieve the goals. So having this scientific mindset, trying to be like scientists, trying to understand why you are wrong, what you can learn out of it, how you can make it better next time, move on very fast, because this failure, this failed experiment doesn't define you. It's a wonderful thing as a leader. And it also builds great learning environment for everyone.
And, you know, I think that parallels one of my takeaways, which was these, what she calls five competence types, or five ideas about what competency must look like, which are unhelpful. And that was the perfectionist, the person who sets impossible goals for themselves and then are disappointed. The superwoman, the person who just thinks if they only work harder, they could do anything, right? The natural genius who thinks any failure is just evidence that you're a fraud. You're not really the genius that you want to be or feel like you should be. The soloist, the person who feels that they ought to be able to do whatever they set their mind to. Whatever it is, they should be able to do it on their own. And the expert, the person who believes that their validity as a human being is based on their present state of their knowledge and skills. Mm-hmm. And all of these are really disastrous ways of telling stories about one's self.
Mm.
I thought that was a useful takeaway as well.
Yes, indeed. So do you want to do one more takeaway before I move to mine? Because I think that there will be imbalance with the takeaway. So you can do two, one.
Well, you know, I did have 27. There's no way I'm going to get to all of them. but there was one kind of high-level one because it came up a lot of times. And I'm curious what you think about it. And that's this concept, which I know you have ideas, about cordial hypocrisy. I love that phrase, cordial hypocrisy. It comes up throughout the book as kind of what happens when you have inauthentic leadership and an unhealthy culture. Is you can get into this situation in which everybody is very polite. I had a friend, one of my best friends, perhaps my best friend, college roommate, high school buddy, got me my first job in IT, absolutely wonderful, wonderful, brilliant, beautiful human being. And one of the things he taught me when we were young, I think I was like 19 years old, is I used to think that if I didn't like somebody, it was okay to be mean to them. And he taught me that the cruelest thing, or maybe not the cruelest thing, but the best way to deal with a person you dislike is to treat them with respect. Politeness. That was it, politeness. If you really don't like someone, just be polite, because that's like the bare minimum, is just saying the things that won't get you into trouble, but don't open any doors either, you know? And when you have these kind of toxic cultures, or you have this lack of trust, one very safe response for employees to have is to deal with it with just politeness. Smile and nod when they disagree. Agree to a task they have no intention of doing. You know, just do nothing to chop the waters. And I love this term for it, cordial hypocrisy. You can walk through a place which is just imbued with cordial hypocrisy and get the impression that it seems a healthy enough place. You know, there's no tension, there's no conflict, and yet nothing's getting done right.
Yeah. And you know, and I think like the online setting enables that even more, because now when you turn off your camera, you can do whatever angry faces you want, you know, but you can still say, you are right. I will. Oh, exactly. And you just turned off your camera. Yeah. But you can just turn off the camera. You can do, you know, add other things, and you can agree to anything. And this is terrifying, you know, this is terrifying, but it's so common. And I remember, because it was also something, Paul, that you taught me when we were talking about writing a resignation letter. You told me,
never give away anything.
Never give away anything. Yeah. As simple as possible. Thank everyone. Wish them a wonderful future. Close the door. Job done. Even if you feel that you are right, even if you feel whatever you want to feel, basic and politeness, and that works. Mm-hmm.
Well, this came up on a LinkedIn conversation recently in which I was talking about toxic management and the way it hurts employees. And somebody said that you should look very carefully not only at the turnover rates per manager, but also at information from exit interviews, to which I responded that exit interviews are usually done by HR. And HR's role in a company is to protect it from lawsuits. It's not to look after the employees. It's to protect it from lawsuits. And the purpose of exit interviews is not to learn and improve as a company. It's to screen for potential lawsuits. And so an intelligent employee will either avoid an exit interview if they can, reschedule until you're not employed anymore, or they will say nothing. They'll just be completely, cordial hypocrisy. They will say nothing that might possibly burn a bridge. Why would you burn a bridge in order to help the company you're leaving?
But, you know, here I have like the funniest and the most hypocritic story ever that I learned. So in one of the companies, and to avoid any lawsuit, I'm not going to say the name of the company, there was the practice of exit interviews. But after a few exit interviews, because the turnover was so high, they decided to destroy the evidence of those exit interviews. Because actually, people were very open. Like they had so much, you know, anger because it was a very hectic and bad time at this company that they were just talking a lot. So the company noticed that that might be a potential risk. So they ordered to destroy any evidence of the exit interviews and forbid exit interviews just in case for the future.
Oh, congratulations on getting out.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe that will move us to a part of the book that talks about feedback. Because I've read about feedback, some books, heard talks. It was a very popular topic on the conferences a few years ago. I remember we're getting a lot of proposals, but also in the other conferences, I've seen a lot. And what I never seen, maybe I mislooked, maybe I didn't hear cautiously enough, is the three types of feedback that she mentioned. That there is the price, simple thank you. There is evaluation, so to learn how you are doing. And there is coaching to help you to get improved. And all of them can be given separately, you know? It doesn't have to be that you have your quarterly, weekly, monthly feedback session and that you have to say something bad, you know, just to help this person grow or to mention some place for the improvement, that you have this Excel spreadsheet maybe for those reviews when you have to find five, not four, things that you want this person to do better. But sometimes the feedback session can be just simple thank you, can be just appreciation. And I had this kind of feedback session recently when I was, you know, prepared with the list of things I'm going to improve in myself, that I could do better, all of those things that I was used to. And they said, no, 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 we just want to thank you. And I was like, what? So you are not going to tell me, you know, how can I get this better and that better? What? Like, no, no, no. Today we just want to thank you. And then when I read in the book also that there's those three types that you can do it separately, I felt, yeah, that's right. And that's so powerful.
Yeah. Wow. I'm so glad you had that experience. That's so rare.
Yeah, I was shocked. Literally, Paul, I don't remember many times in my life when I was shocked because I was really... I did my self-retrospection, you know. I made sure that I already have the plan for improvement for those things and stuff. And they said, no, it's no.
So I think you're triggering another rant here, which I just want to get out.
Yes, we've got, you had the short rant before. I give you one more.
Yeah, a few thousand people will hear this. And so this is worth saying. And I'm channeling Bob Newhart. Folks younger than me won't know Bob Newhart. Bob Newhart was a comedian, an actor, back when I was young, back in the 60s and 70s. And he did this wonderful, wonderful skit. You can find it on YouTube, in which he's a therapist. And a woman comes in and she says, you know, I like your help. And he has this wonderfully dry delivery method. And he was like, all right, what is it? And she says, well, you know, I keep getting into bad relationships with men who I know are not gonna treat me well. And he says, I think I might have some advice for you. And she says, all right, should I write it? And no, you won't need to write it down. Maybe I should write it down if it's really, really that valuable. And no, I think you're gonna be able to remember it. So it's just this, whenever you're meeting a man and you feel like it might be a bad relationship, stop doing that. Stop it. And this is how I feel about the compliment sandwich.
Oh, yeah.
Our thousands of listeners out there, if you have succumbed to this idea of the compliment sandwich, stop doing that. Stop it. It's one of the most pernicious ideas that has crept into from some pseudo-psychology. I'm going to have to dig out the history of this. Where did it come from? Who started this?
Let's do it.
but somehow, at some point in their careers, every manager is taught this. It's like, I've got to do a performance review. What do I do? Oh, you haven't heard about the compliment sandwich? The world has so many goats. Goats live on every single continent except Antarctica, and they'll eat anything. Feed them your compliment sandwich, not your employees.
Yeah, indeed. Because, you know, this is like this green, you know, tasty salad, and boom, this slice of meat in your face. Yeah.
So, yeah, anyway, I guess I had to. I guess I had some bitterness in there I had to get out. I feel better now. I feel lighter.
Okay, so it's good because now you can take another takeaway.
All right, I've got so many. You know, I'm realizing this happens a lot. My takeaways fall into two categories. One is these broad insights, these really useful big ideas. And the other is a bunch of little really pragmatic things. And I'm thinking about taking the pragmatic things and just carrying them over for the after show. One of the things I liked, which is a bigger thing, is this idea of infinite versus finite relationships, where finite relationships are transactional, you know, in which you do this for me and I'll give you this kind of thing. And so many working relationships are that. Like, if you keep ticking off the boxes that I set for you, I will keep paying your salary. Whereas an infinite relationship in business means, in her words, which I really like, creating a we story. Not like the company's doing this, and so I need you to do this in exchange for which I'll pay your salary. But more like we are going someplace. We are part of something bigger than either of us. We are doing this together. We're learning as we go. And building a we story is making a commitment to a future that isn't transactional and that doesn't necessarily have a foreseeable end. Like, if you stop doing this, I will stop doing this. No, it's like we are in this together, and we might go different places. But just the very notion of building a we story, not we as in W-E, you Scottish people, not a little story, but a wee story, as in you and me together forever, is I think a really healthy and inspirational concept for a leader.
And you know, it made me feel a little bit about personal relationships as well, that I noticed, like, with some of the people that I feel like we are going to be, you know, friends for life, disregard of anything, that I just had this feeling. I noticed that I use we more. So it's an interesting internal indicator also that you can see in the language that you have.
Indeed. And it's also one, there's a connection between language and perception. And it goes in both directions. If you use we language, it can create a perception of togetherness. And if you notice we language, it suggests that you already have one.
Okay, that's nice.
You tend to think as you act, because your brain is constant. I mean, Aga is the psychologist. I'm not, but I've read a lot. And your brain is constantly justifying your own behavior to yourself. Yeah. It's like the basis of Franklin's rule. You know, if you're nice to somebody, then you'll likely keep being nice to them because your brain has to make sense of the fact that you've done something for this person, right? And so it all comes down to the kind of stories that we're building for ourselves. And so you can just model the behavior you want to believe in, your brain will find a way to believe it.
Yeah. That's true. But now I have so many sideways that I just have to direct myself back to back to the interview, and maybe I will take all of them to the after show. So another takeaway from me. Multiple step decisions. It's one of the first times that I've heard such a funny metaphor for making decisions. Even though that, as we said, there is so many other things that you can take into consideration, but for the simplicity, let's say, if you buy a donut, it's a one step decision. If you order at the restaurant, in most of the cases, it's a two-step decision. You ask for the menu, you check the menu, you order. If you purchase the car, it's a three-step decision. You also have the test drive in the middle, like very simplistic way. But what is important about this thinking about the steps of making decisions is if you want to engage your stakeholders, you also have to think what kind of decisions and commitment you want from them. Because for you, it might look that this is just buying a donut. You know, you just want to get access to their database. Not a big deal. But for them, this is a huge thing. You know, this means that there are approvals on the way or some things into consideration. So even though that it's extremely simplified and there's a lot of things that can go sideways, I believe that having the understanding of steps that has to be taken in order to have any decision and understanding that your stakeholders might have different order, different complexity can help us to have a better conversations and facilitate collaboration in a better way.
Interesting. I read that slightly differently.
Okay.
Which is that when you arrive at a decision, when you arrive at a conclusion, you might have had a journey to get to that conclusion. It might have been something going on in your head for hours or days or weeks. You might have gone through a multi-step process to come to that conclusion. But once you come to that conclusion, you're convinced. And being right feels like being right, right? Yeah. It just feels like right. And then when you take it to somebody else who didn't have hours or days or weeks to work through it, you expect them to jump straight there to where you are without recognizing that they also have to go through the same steps
yes.
you had to go mm-hmm. through in order to come to that conclusion that this is right. A subtly different perspective. I mean, you're talking about people who have different perspectives, and one of which is one who sees the complexity, the other one doesn't see the complexity. But even when it's internal and everyone understands the same context, the leader might have been mulling over something for a while before they become firmly convinced of something. And then they expect other people to come there without doing the mulling.
Yeah, exactly. That's very good that you also brought that, because that was an important bit of that one. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Oh, so we are already over 50 minutes into this, and I've got a lot left. But I think we're getting down to, in my list anyway, the things that are more practical, precise. Things like the idea of transparency versus translucency, or briefing and back briefing, or the difference between a decision and a choice, or the impact of decision fatigue, that sort of thing. Practical, on-the-ground sorts of ideas. And I would be willing to carry those over for the after show. Do you have anything burning that you
yes.
want to share in terms of takeaways?
I have one more, which was to become comfortable with stress and to not treat it as a bad thing, to treat it as that's our body and that's our brain, whatever, telling us that we care about something. So the same as with imposter syndrome, for me, it's not necessarily the worst thing that can happen. It is actually something that can help you to practice, to prepare more, because you feel like you are missing something. So I think it's important as a leader to be comfortable with stress. It doesn't mean that you cannot show the stress, because that's what I thought for a long time, that, you know, as a leader, you have to be the one that keeps everything in control, that always can, you know, look that everything is fine, even that everything is on fire, so people don't jump out from the building. But I mean, just being comfortable with understanding that it might be a stressful situation and understanding how you are going to deal with it, to also tell people around you that it's okay to feel stressed and find ways to help them and to practice building the resistance every day. Doesn't have to be every day for those of you who might be scared by it. Although it's the first month, it's January, so everyone has a beautiful resolution list. But practice doing the things that scares you every day, maybe not every day, weekly, monthly, but just find something that you are terrified. Like, I was always terrified of water. I started going for diving lessons. I'm not afraid of water anymore. I'm afraid of many more other things right now, but this one is gone. So yeah, being comfortable with stress.
You know, that's a much healthier way of presenting imposter syndrome, I think, than the way Marty Kagan puts it. You know, I when you were talking about that, I was reminded, I used to be afraid of heights, and then I started skydiving. And one of the things I learned in skydiving helped me a lot as a public speaker later on, which is that, and I don't know if this is something all skydivers experience, but when you're 30,000 feet or 25,000 feet off the ground, 30,000 feet is pretty high, 15 to 20 is what we usually jump. And you're either hanging out the back of an airplane or about to step off of it, there are certain physical things that your body does. And I won't describe them. They're not all pretty. But it is an extreme stress reaction. Mm. And after a while, you just realize your body's going to do this, and it's fine. And it's exactly the same thing with public speaking. Every time I get on stage, I have a whole suite of reasonably extreme physical reactions. And I have learned over time that they're not visible. They're completely internal. Mm. And they're a sign that everything is right in the world. I'm about to step onto a stage in front of hundreds of thousands of people. This is how it feels. Mm. And it'll be fine because it always is. And if it wasn't, if I ever walked out on stage and didn't have any of those physical sensations, I would be deeply concerned. Mm. So yes, I like that idea of embracing stress because some situations are inherently stressful and that's a normal human reaction to them.
Indeed. So moving to the favorite quotation, do you have like 50? Because I have three.
I only, you know, so many of the, there's a lot of literary cleverness in this book, but most of it took the form of metaphors and stories. Mm. And so in terms of like concise, neat little quotations, I only have five.
Great. So I start.
Go.
Our emotions are building blocks of stories we tell ourselves.
Okay, yeah, that's a good one. How about this one? Control and trust are incompatible because trust requires the freedom to make decisions and to act in ways that may not necessarily mirror the way the leader imagines or wishes. So you can control or you can trust, but mm-hmm. you can't do both.
Mm, okay, yes. Okay, I got it.
And when I say that, it's also if you flip it and think about a sense of control, of being in control, you as a leader can't feel in control and also trust your people. Mm.
It's like I trust you, but
yeah, you either derive your sense of stability and support. Mm-hmm. Satisfaction that the future will be a good place from control or from trust.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a good
one. My people won't let me down. I don't know where they're taking me, but they won't let me down. Or it's going to happen exactly the way I mm-hmm. said.
Okay, good one. So another one, short one this time. Competitiveness is often called ambition, less often ego. That one made me laugh. Because I don't want to offend anyone who feels that they are ambitious and anyone who is ambitious. But sometimes it's so much fed only by their ego. I don't know how to express it, but it just brought me the funny image of a few people that I know that are like, you're always pushing because they're ambitious and all of those things. And that's the most important thing. And they can do it and they don't see anyone around them. But at the end of the day, it's really their ego that is just screaming. So not to be too judgmental, but that's a little judgmental and that just made me laugh.
I like that. Indeed. My next one, completely different, but I like the insight, is that we tend to ask, why did it fail, more often than why did it succeed?
Mm.
And take what you want of that. I mean, maybe it means that successes deserve more scrutiny than they get, but it also means that if this is a thing that we do, that we have more failure stories and success stories. not because we have more failures than successes, but because we actually extract the stories from our failures and burn them into our culture, whereas our successes just kind of go water under the bridge.
Which I think goes really good with what I was saying about feedback, yeah? That even if you want to give a good feedback, you by default just look for the place to for places of improvements, yeah? Okay, so another one, just to say that ego is not bad. Ego helps you to have faith in yourself. Dare to try things that you have never tried before and make you seek the goals that feel beyond your reach. And yeah, you know, there is this book, Ego is a Bad Designer. But on the other hand, without ego, so many people, so many of us on the daily basis wouldn't dare to do something. Sometimes you just have to trust yourself a lot. You have to probably manifest it in the way that other people might think that you are kind of, I'm not going to use the words here.
Give yourself an A.
Give yourself A plus or A plus plus because you can do it. But yeah, it's also important force in us.
Okay. You know, one of the things I like about this is we're coming up with good quotations from this book, but I didn't see anything in here that made me think, okay, this is going to be Istina's favorite.
Mm.
And in fact, none of your quotations so far overlap mine.
Ah, okay.
So we're finding different things to take away from this book. My next one is metrics. You know me and metrics. Mm-hmm. Metrics seldom trigger a positive emotion by themselves. And that was from a section about the stories we tell, about the impact of our work,
mm-hmm.
and how the stories are more important and the impact is more important. And so if we take our KPIs and we take our various flow metrics and this sort of thing, and we make them the thing, then crossing a particular number, crossing a particular arbitrary boundary, it might mean something wonderful. It might mean nothing at all, but it probably doesn't stimulate an emotional reaction.
Mm.
And it's those emotions that create our stories about ourselves and about ourselves collectively as well. And so you need the context as well as just chasing the numbers.
Yeah, that's true. And those were three of my favorite quotations. So you can just do bam bam with yours, like the next two, I think, that are still left with you.
Okay, I'll just share one more. Okay. And this is actually kind of trite, but maybe somebody needs to hear this. Extinguishing fires is not progress. And a lot of us in this industry are still doing a lot of firefighting. And we get our satisfaction from firefighting. And if you're one of those people, who comes to work, you don't know what's going to happen, but you know that you're the one, you know that when things get bad, you're the one who knows how to focus and get in there and do it right. And that's great for you, but it's not progress. Keeping the fires from starting is progress. And, I don't know. I just like that one. Extinguishing fires is not progress because we take so much satisfaction from it. You go home after solving some critical problem, you feel pretty good about yourself.
Mm.
But organizationally, that's not where anybody wants to be.
But you know, I also think that it's not progress because it means that you multiple fires, like you might have a problem with prioritization of your fires. You just create more, you just scream louder and your fires will be put down first, even though that it's just in your little notebook rather than throughout the whole floor, you know, like the story of those three peaks and the houses that they built.
Mm. Mm-hmm. All right. So we got into a lot, but we left so much on the table. That I think we're going to have a very interesting after show. What do you think about the idea of inviting Michał to join us for the after show? Having a three-way. Because he's the one who recommended this book to us. And he's one of our Patreon subscribers.
Okay, we can do it.
Okay, cool. So we'll do that. We already have an idea for the next book. A friend of ours, Jim Benson, has written a book called The Collaboration Equation, Strong Professionals, Strong Teams, Strong Delivery. I'm hearing good things about it. He wrote it last summer, but I haven't read it yet, and I'd like to. And I like the way he thinks about things. Do you know how I met Jim Benson?
No.
It was really funny. It was like way, way back when, ages and ages ago, like 15 years ago or so, I was giving, it wasn't a talk. I was giving a talk about Kanban, but I did an open space session on personal Kanban, mm-hmm. I want to say in Bucharest, and I was tweeting about it. And he wrote to me and said, what's this personal Kanban thing? I'm working on a book with that title. Maybe we should talk. And indeed, it was a wonderful book. And he's a wonderful man. He came out and did a session, not a session, a workshop on personal Kanban at one of the ACEs several years back. So have you met him?
No.
Okay, you'll like him. You'll like him. He's wonderful.
Okay.
So our next book is going to be The Collaboration Equation, Strong Professionals, Strong Teams, Strong Delivery by Jim Benson. And then as for the rest of our thoughts about leadership by design, those of you who support us on Patreon, and I don't care how much. I mean, I do. We've got bills to pay. But we don't make us, we don't segregate our audience by, or we don't segregate our supporters by how much they support us. Everyone gets all the things. And so even if you just buy us a cup of coffee a month, even if you just pledge a buck a month, you get all the content that we create for the after show, which I think this time is going to be interesting because we not only have the after show in which we're going to go deep, 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 deep into leadership by design, not to mention a bunch of other things like this. I want to talk to you about this Game of Thrones season 8
yes.
redo. I want to talk to you about your ultra marathon that you finished in France. I want to talk to you about some new models of coaching that I'm investigating that are working really well. I want to hear what you think about Hive.
Yes.
You bought it. You played it months ago and we still haven't, you still haven't given me feedback on that. So we've got a bunch of personal and fun and professional stuff to get into. Deep dive into leadership by design. And I think we're also going to do a special episode for our Patreon subscribers in which we do another experiment. And that is that we've done a couple of things. We've done extra book reviews where Eustin and I just do our thing with a book, but just for our Patreon subscribers. I did one where I did it by myself. I think you were really busy that mm-hmm. month. I read
just
a book. I just did the whole format, but by myself. And the feedback was that, yeah, that's nice, but kind of dry, you know, with just one voice. And so we're going to experiment with something else. And that is we're going to have a discussion about a book that I read and Eustina didn't.
But I bought 5 copies today.
What?
I bought 5 copies of this book today, The 4,000 Weeks. I bought it for the gift for other people. So I'm not going to read it until we record the after show, but I already have 5 copies.
You haven't even read it and you're giving it away?
Yeah, because you said it's good and I read just, you know, the general idea and I loved it so much and I had to do something to constrain myself from not reading. So I thought I will just give it to other people.
Okay, well, so for our Patreon subscribers, even just a buck a month are going to get access to all of that extra content. And if you want to help out the show and you don't want to give us money, I get that. That's fine. But you would be amazed at how much help it can be just to give us, you know, a thumbs up, a positive review on whichever podcasting service you use. It really helps us to get that. There's so many podcasts out there, even just in the agile space, you can get kind of lost. If you think this is something worth listening to, which I guess you do because you just spent an hour and 10 minutes on it. So if you don't, then what are you doing with your life? But if you do think it's worth listening to, then let other people know that it exists. Tell your friends and give us positive reviews on whichever podcast service you use. We really appreciate it. It makes a huge difference to us, not only in terms of our reach, but also in terms of our emotional gratification. And it's so nice to see a positive review. They don't come that often. I mean, not that negative reviews come all the time. There was only one. Still don't know who that was. Probably someone that fired years ago. But offset that one with your positive review, and we would really appreciate it. Our next podcast is going to be coming out in less than a month because this one's late, and it's going to be an interview with the author of Leadership by Design. We'll be talking to Aga Shustek and diving into a few of these concepts that were really intriguing and that that maybe we didn't explore as well as we could have in this podcast. So join us for that if you're not a Patreon subscriber.
Perfect. Join us. Thank you very much, everyone. Have a wonderful 2023.
Welcome to 2023. The year where being late is okay.
Oh, that's perfect. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.